Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap, and joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel, how you doing?
I'm doing good. It's Memorial Day this weekend, and in honor of that holiday, what is your favorite food to grill?
I'm going to grill eggplant.
Eggplant is pretty good on the grill. I'll give you that.
It's so good on the grill. You olive oil both sides and then bam.
A little salt.
Easy.
Pepper,
salt, pepper, you're done. Done. How about you?
I'm a simple hot dog guy.
I know it.
I love a good hot dog. What can I say?
This has been shared with me recently. Yeah. All right. Well, I hope everybody has a good weekend. But before then, right, we're going to bring you first on this episode, the first episode. I am going to say that again. Here we go. But before Memorial Day weekend, we are bringing you the first episode of a new multimedia series on The Wrap called Conversations on Cancel Culture. In this discussion, which was moderated by yours truly, we discuss cancel culture in journalism. What happens when journalists become the target of social media campaigns? Is canceling a necessary sign of accountability, or is it a scary slide into intolerance? We will discuss.
All right, but first, Sharon, let's get into some headlines. Another week, another big media merger. Amazon announced this week that it will acquire MGM Studios for nearly $8.5 billion. The deal marks Amazon's biggest entry in the entertainment content business and stands at its second biggest acquisition behind the $13.7 billion it spent to buy Whole Foods in 2017. MGM boasts a library of 4,000 film titles and 17,000 hours of TV programming, but Amazon will only get half of the James Bond franchise. Longtime 007 producers Barbara Broccoli and her brother Michael Wilson maintain the other half. Sharon, I think there's a lot to parse through with this deal. What aspect of it has you the most intrigued?
Yeah, it's a big deal. We knew it was coming. Well, let me just mention that although James Bond is the most famous piece of content and IP that MGM has, it's not the reason, I don't believe, that Amazon did this deal. Because in fact, as Beatrice Verhoeven, one of our reporters, our film editor, wrote this week, it's the Broccolis who have control over the decision making.
Control, really.
Yeah, and they always have, and they're very, very wedded to theatrical, and they're very, strict on what they want, and they have a particular vision of what the James Bond brand is and what it should remain. So that wouldn't be why Amazon bought it, to do spinoffs and prequels, and you know, maybe that'll happen. But
a
maybe
young Bond series, that would be amazing.
There's a million things you could think of to do, but that doesn't mean that they're going to get done, and it really doesn't depend on what Amazon wants to do. But this huge library, to me, is Amazon, as you say, making a very big bid for dominance in the content industry and entertainment. And the most remarkable part of it for me is to really just step back and look at how tech companies have come to take such a prominent and indeed dominant role in Hollywood over the past 10 years. It's happened step by step. These tech companies, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, they've come in and have essentially taken over traditional Hollywood. So I do think that if we think about this on a continuum of a timeline, this is going to be one of the places you have like a little asterisk, like boom, the moment that Amazon bought MGM will be one of those moments on the timeline that really demonstrate how tech took over Hollywood. That's my thought.
I know. It seems like we're not that far away from, we thought the opposite was going to happen, right? Like you thought someone was going to buy Netflix when they were coming up, and you thought maybe.
They could have. Because the only company that can really compete with those guys right now is Disney. It's the only one. They have the resources. They have the breadth of divisions. They have the ability to make Yoda dolls. That will make undoubtedly more money than one of the Star Wars movies, any one of the Star Wars movies. So they have the ability to monetize the content that they make. Just think about what Amazon, the retail behemoth what it could do if it was merchandising James Bond or Legally Blonde or Handmaid's Tale or any of Pink Panther, really anything that they would want to dip into that incredible archive and monetize. And for sure they will. So the question of sort of who runs, who holds the balance of power in Hollywood, this to me is going to be a landmark moment that illustrates that it's the distribution platforms that have that hold the balance of power. And over the past year of the pandemic, what we've seen accelerate, and we've talked about it ad nauseum on this show, is that distribution over the internet has stepped to the fore to become the number one most important priority for every distributor. So if distribution matters more than the content, and if internet distribution matters is king among all distribution, then the Amazons of the world and Netflix of the world are poised to be the kingmakers.
I think it'll be interesting to see how Apple responds. Are they going to try and find someone to swoop up next?
They could, but they're spending something like $20 billion on content in the next period of time, next year, 2 years. So they're investing heavily in original content, but that doesn't mean that they here's the other thing about this is that a company like Apple, a company like Amazon are completely price insensitive to the cost of these companies, and they can spend absolutely whatever they want to buy them. They're sitting on boatloads of cash, and they have this scale and the resources beyond the purchase price to develop these libraries and these different kinds of IP. So let's just hope they don't friggin' ruin it, because so far, as we know, Jeff Bezos spent something like $500 million, trying to on the Lord of the Rings prequel, and that has not come together. And to buy the IP, he overpaid for that too, and he just wanted it. So it's going to be interesting. Somebody who is, I think, very smart about this stuff said to me that the velocity of this kind of change is not going to abate; is going to increase. So everybody needs to take all their vitamins, because you're going to need it for whatever's coming around the bend. Okay, on to
yes,
Kevin Spacey. Well, talk about Kevin Spacey. He is making a comeback. The actor has faced, as everybody knows, multiple accusations of sexual misconduct, but he has landed his first role in almost 3 years. He's going to star in The Man Who Drew God from the Italian director Franco Nero. Kevin Spacey last appeared on screen in 2018's Billionaire's Boys Club, but he was, of course, famously written off of House of Cards and replaced as the lead in All the Money in the World after these allegations surfaced. And Christopher Plummer, who replaced him, got an Oscar nomination for the part. Spacey has not been convicted of any crime, although he does still face charges. To date, he has settled one of the lawsuits against him. Daniel, what do you think about this issue of Kevin Spacey getting work on screen?
I think it's totally fine. I just don't have to watch it, and I probably won't. Mm-hmm.
You probably have to work pretty hard to find an Italian movie by this.
Yeah, it'll be very curious.
Director, I don't know, but
where it shows up. He's got every right to do so, and the film is, and the directors and the people have every right to cast him. I just probably won't watch it. I think people deserve second chances when they make a mistake. He has a pattern of behavior that I just don't personally want to reward with my time and dollars. And so good luck to him. I hope he keeps dropping insane videos on YouTube every Christmas, as he's done the last few years. Those I will enjoy, because they're
completely bizarre,
batshit crazy.
Yeah.
For a film to cast him, what are you thinking is going to happen? It's not going to be well received. You're probably just desperate, I guess. I don't know. I can't imagine what the thinking is in even offering him a part.
I don't know. I don't know the backstory of how that came about. You know, there's all kinds of relationships and friendships that might be happening in the background. I don't know what's behind these odd videos that Kevin Spacey has posted to social media, in which he seems to believe that he has agency, or that there's room in the public sphere to hear him, rather than to make him kind of an object of curiosity and ridicule, which is kind of what I think those things were. But what's interesting about this coming up is it's right on target with this series that we're doing on cancel culture, which has been really interesting and edifying to put together. And one of the topics that we're looking at, that's the last one in the series, is about rehabilitation and can you come back from being canceled and how can you come back from being canceled? And clearly, you know, there are people who have not been convicted in a court of law who justifiably feel like they shouldn't be shut out of society. They should be judged in a court of law or left alone. And since that hasn't, and for years, by the way, Harvey, who settled one case after another and got these women to sign these very onerous NDAs, got away with very bad behavior for a long time using that logic. But it is, you know, in a flawed society, in a flawed democratic system and judicial system, that is how it's supposed to work right now. And that's why we're talking about this in our series, is that isn't really how it's working. Social media or social pressure or social norms that have been determined by I don't know whom are determining things and determining whether people are acceptable as a side or not. So you can't force your way back in, and we'll see how people receive this.
Yeah, I think Mel Gibson's an interesting example of someone who went away for a while, and you know, he's not at the same level
but he's not acceptable company.
He's still working plenty.
He's not somebody who is considered acceptable company in Hollywood. He has tons of money, so he can produce independently anything he wants, and there are people who will continue to work with him, people who like him, who are his friends, but I would not say that he's somebody who people are comfortable just treating him like any other actor. Oh, Mel Gibson, oh, Tom Cruise, oh, George Clooney. It's certainly not the same, but yes, he has found some kind of way to continue working. That's true.
So yeah, anything is possible. So speaking of comebacks, this Memorial Day weekend, we've got not one, but two big movies coming out in theaters. Paramount's A Quiet Place 2 and Disney's Cruella both come out this weekend. And yes, I know you can watch Cruella at home if you want on Disney Plus Premier Access. It's $29.99. But still, this marks the biggest weekend at the box office in over a year. Our box office expert, Jeremy Fuster, talked to a number of analysts, and they say A Quiet Place could take in anywhere between 36 and 50 million this weekend, and Cruella could do about 20. So Sharon, are you excited about this big weekend, or are you worried that maybe if the box office doesn't do too well, it's going to be a bad sign of things to come?
No, I'm excited to see what happens this weekend. I think you've got two really strong movies. You've got a full-on Memorial Day holiday extra for people to go out and go watch the movies. If the movie does well as a paid VOD on Disney Plus for $29.99, that's also a win. And so we'll see how I'd be very curious to see how those numbers come in. So I think A Quiet Place Part II is a movie that's been waiting for a long time to come out in theaters, and Paramount waited to put it in theaters. I bet that's going to do really well. Cruella has kind of had mixed reviews, I have to say. I think that the one sheet, the poster is like super cool. So if I were the target audience, which I am not, it would certainly draw me to the theater. I'm more probably likely to go see A Quiet Place rather than Cruella. But Cruella, of course, you know, if you buy it on Disney Plus, you'll be able to watch it with your whole family for the same, you know, price of $29.99. So I suspect that families will take advantage of that opportunity. I'm going to bet that the box office is going to do pretty well this weekend.
It'll be interesting. It's still going to be, and you almost hate saying this, it's not fair. It's going to be the lowest Memorial Day box office in 20 some odd years.
But that's not fair.
Yeah, it's not. I fully admit it. It's usually a huge weekend. 2019, I think, set the record. It was 230 million. I forget which film it was then. But, you know, this weekend, you know, it'll be lucky to even, it probably won't get to 100.
I mean, then we've got some other big movies coming, right? We've got F9 coming up.
Oh, now's the start, yeah.
Yeah, so.
In the Heights,
excited.
In July, we get Black Widow.
Really is going to feel like there are reasons to go to the theater. I bet people will go, but that's me.
I certainly hope so. Fingers crossed.
Exactly.
All right. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, which allows our founder and editor-in-chief, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to sound off about something she is particularly into this week, her Wax On, and maybe something she's a little more upset about, riled up about, her Wax Off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
I'm going to do two wax-ons, but they're really quick. First, shout out to Governor Gavin Newsom for your tirade of indignant, righteous rage about the lack of gun control and lack of sane limits on guns in this country. That was in the wake of the San Jose shooting of 8 people this week. Thank you, Gavin Newsom, for speaking what all of us are thinking. My other wax on is that I quickly, because I want to get it out there, is we're starting our Emmy season screening series this week, next week. I moderated one that we recorded in advance this week that was really cool. It was a group of 6 supporting actor contenders, all on HBO shows. And it was for shows from The Undoing to Hacks to Perry Mason, Time May Destroy You. And it, amazingly, 5 out of the 6 actors on this panel were people of color. And it was just really cool that we have enough great shows out there that showcase people, actors of color who are able to like be on the leading front lines of being in contention for the Emmy. We always have had a little bit of diversity, and the industry's been working on being more inclusive, but to just naturally see this amount of talent, diverse talent bubble up was really exciting and part of the pattern that I have been noticing and hope that very much will continue. So that's my wax on. I hope you'll tune in, by the way, to watch that panel next week because it'll be streaming online. My wax off is, again, going back to the question of cancel culture and cancellation. You know, a number of months ago when we started talking about this, I saw and occasionally do still see people saying that cancel culture doesn't exist. It's not a thing. It's just accountability, just calling people out for their bad behavior. But I don't think that that is true. And that is why we decided to do this series, that I think there are very damaging effects to having a culture where people can just be hounded or intimidated into silence or have their institutions or their bosses intimidated by the loudest voices, not the most important and not the most numerous voices in the room, but seeing time after time that institutions cave to very loud, insistent voices on who decide for all of us where the line is, what accountability means. So we're seeing this now. This was what I was predicting when we started this series, that you know it started as like the progressive movement, so to speak, calling out either racism or other forms of social injustice, and you know, considering this accountability. And my concern was like, well, you know, it's going to start on the left and that may feel all well and good, but it's going to circle around and bite you in the ass. And that is actually what we're seeing. So when you have a case where the scholar and journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones was denied tenure at UNC under the pressure of conservative groups, that is part of what happens when institutions begin to cave to this culture of nothing is ever good enough or nothing, or this makes me uncomfortable, or this opinion is not something that I think is valid. And even when you have somebody like Rick Santorum on the right being finally driven out of CNN. Now, is Rick Santorum my cup of tea? He is not. But do I think that he should not have a place to speak out? I do. He should be allowed to speak. I'm a pretty diehard believer in freedom of expression. And Seth Rogen came in and weighed in on this week on this topic as well this week, talking about comedy and how, you know, going back and skewering people for what their remarks in comedy in the past, like it doesn't always work with where the culture has moved to. But we do have to understand that sometimes culture and expectations and values and norms do move with time. And so just pushing people out of the public square because of that isn't always a win. So that's my wax off. How about you?
I'll build on you a little bit. You know, I can't really point you to anything right now, but I am doing the cancel culture panel on comedy, which I'm really excited about. You mentioned Seth Rogen talking about it's okay that jokes age poorly. It's fine. You should be able to look back on it and learn. And there's so much about comedy that is very interesting when it comes to cancel culture, because, you know, a lot of comedians believe that they should be allowed to talk about anything and go anywhere on stage. And if people get offended by it, so be it. The history of offensive comedians is as old as comedy. And so it's going to be a fun discussion to see how they feel about the issue and how they've changed in the last few years. I'm really excited. I think it's going to be a great talk. I think it's a really interesting.
Well, I also think that comedians are like, they're always the canaries in the coal mine for sort of what you could, what truth, how much truth, how much painful truth you can speak.
I think you pointed this out when we first had this discussion. I think this modern era of cancel culture kind of started with comedians who thought that college campuses were too PC for them to perform. They thought that they couldn't joke in front of college people anymore because they got offended too easily. I think that was sort of like a little bit of the birth of this in some ways. So it's a really interesting topic. I'm really excited to talk about it. I'm really excited for everyone to listen to that first part, which will be coming up after this break. All right, that'll do it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, as I just said, part one of the Rap's new series on cancel culture. Stick around.
For our first roundtable in this series, Conversations on Cancel Culture, we wanted to start with journalism, which is the foundation of any free society. We have many, many examples of journalists around the world being pressured or punished, and sometimes not even for their journalism, but sometimes it's for their actions elsewhere. And there's a very broad range of consequences that we can discuss, whether it's the New York Times op-ed page editor James Bennett losing his job after publishing a column by Republican Senator Tom Cotton that was controversial, or the young Black editor of Teen Vogue losing her position for comments she made on social media as a teenager about Asian people. And we want to talk about how real-life violence can impact journalists' ability to do their work. We're very honored to have an extremely distinguished panel of journalists and cartoonists and people who work in journalism in various ways and who are impacted by this issue to join us today. So let's start with our panelists and then we'll get into the issues. Susie Bunny Karam is the former head of Global News Gathering and an executive vice president at Vice News. Before that, she was the editorial director of Gizmodo Media Group, and before that, the first filmmaker in residence at Harvard University's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, where she directed and produced the documentary Enemies of the People, Trump and the Political Press. Danielle Belton is the editor-in-chief of HuffPost, the newly minted editor-in-chief of HuffPost, I should say. Before that, she was the editor-in-chief of the leading Black interest news site, The Root. Before joining The Root, Danielle was editor-at-large for the Black women news site, Clutch Magazine Online, and was the first Black woman to lead a writer's room in Late Night as the head writer for BET Network's NAACP Image Awards nominated talk show, Don't Sleep. Gerard Biard, joining us from Paris, is the editor-in-chief of the satirical French news magazine, Charlie Hebdo. Gerard has been associated with Charlie Hebdo since 1992, when it was relaunched after a 10-year hiatus. He was in London for a conference when Charlie Hebdo's Paris office was targeted in a January 2015 terrorist attack in which 12 people were tragically killed and 11 were injured. Finally, Daryl Cage is an editorial cartoonist and founder of the syndicate Kegel Cartoons, Inc. The syndicate distributes Daryl's work along with 10 columnists and about 70 of the world's top editorial cartoonists to over 700 subscribing newspapers, including half of America's daily paid circulation newspapers. He's also a past president of the National Cartoonist Society and the National Cartoonist Society Foundation. So welcome to all of you. Really accomplished people. Thank you for being here. I think some of you guys are on mute, so I'm just going to presume you all just said thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
We did.
Terrific. Okay. I know that we've asked to be on mute, but this is meant to be a conversation, and so I'm just going to override that and just say when you want to jump in, jump on in. So I've had the privilege of speaking with most of you before we started this panel, and this is a topic that I've been very eager to get into, but also a little bit scared to get into, because it's a scary time for journalism in a lot of ways. And one of the things that keeps coming up is, what actually is cancel culture? What does it mean to you? And Susie, I wanted to start with you and just see if we can't come up with a definition of this kind of slightly toxic phrase at this point that we can, you know, start the conversation with.
Well, look, I think one of the problems with this whole sort of conversation around cancel culture is that the concept of canceling someone has really evolved in a way that's flattened what it means, right? So this concept sort of started among communities of color. This really became sort of prevalent through Black Twitter. And then over time, the term has been sort of appropriated by people sort of in bad faith, right, to mean anything that they want it to mean, right? So the right, especially in America, the sort of right uses cancel culture to sort of describe this kind of moral panic, right? This idea that, you know, everything is being canceled and, you know, everyone has to be careful what they say. On the other hand, the right is also, you know, pulling Liz Cheney from her leadership position, and they're not referring to that as canceling her, right? Because literally she's losing a position. So I think part of the problem is that there's like two sort of separate things that are embedded in cancel culture. One is what it was intended to be, which was consequence culture, right? That there's certain accountability that people in power need to have, and that now, you know, because of social media and because there's more outlets to organize and show dissent, that, you know, people in power now face more consequences. And then there's something else, which is sort of this outrage culture, which is a different sort of thing that goes on, right? Which is just this kind of jumping on the bandwagon and getting really mad at someone for something that feels a bit inconsequential, or someone who doesn't really have a lot of power, right? And I think we need to kind of separate those two things and talk about them separately, because part of the problem is that nobody really knows what they're talking about when they talk about cancel culture.
Well, you had a pretty good definition when you and I were speaking earlier. You called it, you said, to me, it feels like the weaponized silencing of progressive thinking. That was what you said. I thought that was pretty good. Although I'm not sure it only applies to progressive thinking, to your point about Liz Cheney and other people who, you know, might be canceled, so to speak. Danielle, you also had an interesting perspective on how to define this term, which I do agree is being distorted and misappropriated, and we should talk about what we mean when we're talking about it in this conversation.
Sure. So, I totally agree with Susie. I feel like the phrase has lost all sense of its original intention. Mm. You know, for me, the idea of someone being canceled was about holding people in positions of power who had done bad things, you know, responsible. The idea that if you have harmed people, if you're an abuser, if you're a racist, if you've actually done things that, you know, negatively impact people's lives, you know, maybe you don't deserve the position that you have, and, you know, to give your opinion in this particular way. And so that has always been the way that I saw it. Seeing it kind of like twisted and distorted and doing this thing now where it's just like just going after people for speaking out about just about anything now, is very different and has nothing to do with cancel culture. It's something that's always existed in American society. I have dealt with hate mail from white supremacist groups since I was 18 or 19 years old, when I was editor in chief of my college newspaper. This is just built into the fabric of American society. And I think we need to differentiate between just a bunch of noise on the internet when people just get their, you know, so to speak, panties in a bunch and want to go in on somebody and crack jokes is very different from the potential violence of extremism. You know, and so I think it's important to separate the two from each other, because those are two entirely different conversations. You know, the times that I've been quote unquote dragged, you know, on Twitter, over my opinion, you know, it hurt my feelings, but that's all it did. You know, it didn't impact my life anything more than my feelings got hurt. And that was the consequence of me putting my opinion out there and then dealing with people who didn't agree with it. It's very different from, you know, the hate mail that I received from extremists who feel that I shouldn't have a voice as a Black woman in American society. And there's an implied violence that comes with that. There's a real fear that that extremism is going to turn to something much deeper and more dangerous, because we have a history of it in this country of extremist violence, particularly against people on the left. So I feel like we have to be really careful about what exactly we're talking about, because to me, there's a big difference, a huge difference between legitimate criticism, people who are just trolling, and things that could actually lead to the loss of life.
Mm-hmm. Although it's difficult to decide to figure out who's in charge of deciding, you know, who's in what bucket. But Daryl, let me turn to you, because you represent this huge group of editorial cartoonists, and you've experienced what you consider to be the effect of cancel culture on your work, on the work of the artists, the cartoonists that you represent. Can you share that with us?
Well, we see it breaking down in two ways. The changes from editors being less receptive to a broad range of views, and the aggressiveness of governments around the world harassing and terrorizing cartoonists. Just about half of the population of the world, well, more than half of the population of the world, lives in a country where cartoonists are not allowed to draw their own leaders. We have a cartoonist in our
group. You said draw their own leaders, meaning drawing like the president?
The presidents of their country. You don't see cartoonists in China drawing Xi Jinping. You never saw a cartoonist in Cuba draw a Castro. We have two cartoonists in Singapore who tell me, we're free to draw anything we want, Daryl. We just can't draw anything about Singapore. It's the nature of the world. You know, you can get thrown in jail for drawing a cartoon in India. It was a cartoonist in Bangladesh who got out of jail about a month ago, tortured in prison for his cartoon about criticizing Bangladesh's COVID response. He suffered permanent loss of hearing. In our own group, one of our cartoonists late last year was imprisoned for drawing a cartoon critical of an Arab regime. One of our cartoonists in Venezuela, Rema Soprani, escaped from harassment and threats from the Venezuelan regime, and she's drawing from Florida now. That's a happy story.
Is this different from just general lack of freedom of speech in countries that are not democracies? Is there do you see a distinction between what's happening today than maybe what has always been the case?
Well, actually, I think editorial cartoonists are in much the same boat as journalists in general. This is a terrible time and a dangerous time for journalists around the world. And editorial cartoonists are kind of the canaries in the coal mine of journalism. We are on the front lines, and you know, regimes are especially intolerant of cartoons more than they are words. Our websites are under constant attack from what appears to be third world regimes, and we're supported by this company Cloudflare and their project Galileo for small journalism sites that suffer from outsized hacker attacks trying to take us down. And sometimes they do take us down. But, you know, it's not a criminal thing. There's no money to be made, no secrets to be released. What they want to do is erase our hard drives and our archives. It's happened a couple of times. It's a constant battle. That didn't used to exist. The nature of the response to editorial cartoons has evolved into the typical response we get are from people who are offended, who want to somehow punish the artist who offended them. They come to me because I'm perceived to be the guy who can fire a cartoonist. They want an apology, and they want the cartoon to be removed. These come from different interest groups, but there's a commonality to them. But you know, the issues with the cartoonists around the world is just a horror. And we have a cartoonist in Slovakia who was sued by the Prime Minister of Slovakia. That's an EU country, supposed to have a free press. And he sued because the Prime Minister had his feelings hurt by the cartoon, went to the Supreme Court, and it was found in the cartoonist's favor, but that's not really the point. These lawsuits are intended to chill cartoonist speech and to be very expensive so that, you know, the cartoonist thinks twice about criticizing someone in power. A friend of mine, Ali Dilem in Algeria, draws for the Liberté newspaper. He tells me he's always got a handful of lawsuits active from government officials who were somehow bothered by his cartoons. Now, on the other hand, here in America, I'm quite safe. And I suffer a different kind of an issue with cancel culture, which is the attitudes of editors. And there are all kinds of examples of difficult cancel culture for cartoons here. For example, just about 2 months ago, we saw a situation I'd never seen before where an entire newspaper chain, Gannett, canceled comic strip Mallard Fillmore, conservative comic strip, across all of their newspapers at the corporate level. It's never happened before. Typically,
what was the reason editors, for that? What was the reason for that?
They didn't give it a reason, but at the time there was blowback about what I think were vile transgender bashing in Mallard Fillmore. And that is something that we're seeing from the conservative cartoonists. I've killed a couple of transgender bashing cartoons myself. I've actually become more active in killing cartoons than I had in the past, which is something I'm not happy about, but I killed a couple of Dominion voting system accused of fraud cartoons. Typically in the past, I would kill cartoons that were too sexually explicit. Editorial cartoons are a part of state mandated AP history testing in 8th and 11th grade. So we have a lot of high school and middle school readers, and I need to keep the cartoons middle school safe. Right. You know, we sell to the tests for the schools, and we sell to the textbooks that teach to the tests. A common email I get is, "Dear Mr. Cagle, please explain the cartoon to me. My paper's due tomorrow." in that respect, you know, my French cartoon colleagues think of American cartoonists as prudes. And, you know, they're kind of right. They can get away with drawing things that we just can't get editors to even consider.
You were pointing out to me that you found that newspaper editors had been shying away from criticism of Trump during the Trump administration, and that you thought that was a certain chilling of a willingness to enter into kind of topics that would provoke.
Well, keep in mind, we've got just about half of America's daily newspapers that subscribe to our service. There's about 1,400 daily newspapers in America. We've got about 700 and about 200 more internationally or not defined as newspapers. And we keep good statistics on what cartoons the editors choose to publish. So from us, from our 70 cartoonists, they're probably getting more than 20 cartoons a day to choose from. And they probably also subscribe to one of the competing syndicates and get another 5 to 10 cartoons. So they have enough that they can choose whatever they are predisposed to choose. And we've noticed over the years that editors have been becoming more and more timid and rejecting printing cartoons that express opinions. And that, because we collect stats on each of the cartoons and we can compare what the usage is between different cartoons. And there used to be a kind of a general consensus that because most newspapers are in rural and suburban areas that tend to be conservative, that conservative cartoonists would be reprinted more. And you would see that in the newspapers. The conservative papers would run a conservative cartoon. The liberal papers would run both left and right, compare left and right. And it was a pretty stark difference. We've noticed that difference disappear. Both the liberal and the conservative papers are printing the same cartoons, which are cute little asides on topical subjects that don't express an opinion. During the Trump years, we saw this progress to be cartoon editors choosing not to choose cartoons that feature Trump at all. So as Trump is dominating the news every day, and so many cartoonists are drawing Trump because that's where their passion is and that's where the news and the issues of the day are, the editors simply were not reprinting those cartoons. And we saw the progress of printing cartoons at the beginning of the Trump administration going to the last year and a half, and those cartoons just being almost entirely ignored by editors, which was is shocking and very, very frustrating for cartoonists because, you know, we have a kind of a macho attitude among cartoonists. We want to hit people on the head with our opinions. We want to speak truth to power. We want to draw the most powerful cartoons that we can. And to come up against this filter of editors filtering out all of this, all of the expressions of opinion, and just going with the cute little jokes, you know, I've had my vaccination, now I can hug grandma. That's very frustrating for cartoonists. It goes against the nature of what we want to do and why we're in this profession.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing that. Gerard, please, we were all completely devastated on behalf of what happened at Charlie Hebdo in 2015, and feels like could have been yesterday. Can you tell us sort of what has been the impact on Charlie Hebdo and on speech in France in general? Because obviously that's a message to all journalists. It's not just a message to Charlie Hebdo. And how you've continued to do your work in the years after this attack.
Alors, il y a deux choses dans votre question. C'est d'abord comment nous avons continué à travailler. Ça a été compliqué. J'en ai beaucoup parlé. D'autres dans la rédaction ont aussi beaucoup parlé. Mais il était hors de question pour nous d'arrêter Charlie Hebdo et d'arrêter de faire, de dessiner et d'écrire comme nous l'avions toujours fait. Parce que c'était précisément ce que les terroristes qui nous ont attaqués le 7 janvier souhaitaient. Donc il était hors de question de leur donner raison.
Let's get a translation from Timothy.
For Charlie Hebdo, I would have the question to stop being Charlie Hebdo, of course, because that was the aim of the terrorists. So the first thing was to keep doing the job and keep thinking, saying, drawing the thing that they were used to do before. And the second part of the answer of Gérard.
Alors après maintenant il y a ce qui a changé au niveau de tous les autres médias. Il y a la peur du terrorisme, il y a la peur de ce racket terroriste qui voudrait nous imposer de ce que l'on doit dire et ce que l'on ne doit pas dire, ce que l'on doit dessiner, les sujets que l'on doit aborder. Mais il y a aussi, et là ça rejoint le débat que nous avons aujourd'hui, la conversation que nous avons aujourd'hui, il y a toute cette tendance qui n'existait pas avant en France, ce que l'on appelle donc la cancel culture, qui est quelque chose, comme l'a dit Daniel Belton, c'est quelque chose qui fait partie de la culture américaine. En France, c'est quelque chose qui nous était totalement inconnu jusqu'à aujourd'hui, parce que il y a toujours eu de la censure en France, il y a toujours eu une censure, mais c'est une censure institutionnelle qui est organisée par l'État.
Je vais peut-être. Yes. So in all the other newspapers in France, different from Charlie Hebdo, which are not on the same level of issues. There is the same issue that the terrorists, there is a general fear of being imposed what to say, what to think, what to publish. And of course, everyone is afraid about that, but they don't want to change their lines. So on the issue of cancel culture, which is different from the terrorist attacks, of course, because we are talking about something more general, more a general state of mind in the press and in the social media, for example. So this is something different, because in France, the censorship basically was more institutional at the time when Charlie Hebdo was born, during the first years of the current republic. And so the American culture, which you talk about, Daniel, is very different. And in France, it's quite a new thing to have a new kind of censorship, which is not censorship like we used to think in the institutional way. So this is a different time, and the journalists have to adapt to what is going on right now under the influence of the American culture, of course, but in general, in society, and yeah, I'll let Gérard continue his words.
Oui, c'est une forme de, pour moi, c'est une forme de censure qui ne dit pas son nom, qui est non plus le fait d'institutions, d'institutions étatiques ou d'institutions religieuses, comme ça a toujours été le cas, comme c'était le cas avant, mais qui est le fait d'individus ou de groupes d'individus qui sont bien souvent des militants, qui agissent au nom d'idées tout à fait défendables, au nom de l'antiracisme, au nom du féminisme, au nom de la défense des minorités. Tout cela est parfaitement défendable, et ce sont des combats que nous menons aussi depuis longtemps à Charlie Hebdo, depuis le début. Simplement, ce sont des militants très radicaux et qui s'organisent avec une arme qui est au fond très 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 nouvelle pour les rédactions, qui sont les réseaux sociaux, qui donne une idée totalement déformée de l'opinion générale.
When you talked about American culture, so this is the new kind of censorship that we are saying now, which is not about institutions, but about group of people, individuals, organized group of people that are pushing progressive ideas like anti-racism, feminism, minority, the defense of any kind of minorities, which is a topic that Charlie has always been engaged in. They were in all that fight since its beginning, but here these kind of groups of people are organized and with a new kind of weapon, should we say, that are social media, and this is something quite different for the institutional media, printed classical media, because social media have a different kind of perspective, and the general opinion that is expressed on social media is of course quite not the same that what could say the majority of the people. So this kind of organizations targeting sometimes journalists or cartoonists for their views, cartoons and or anything, it's a new thing that they have to include in their state of mind and in their work.
Je vais vous donner un exemple tout récemment. Le journal Le Monde publiait depuis des années une série qui s'appelle les Indégivrables, d'un dessinateur qui s'appelle Xavier Gorce. Et il y a eu, alors là, je ne sais pas si vous avez suivi cette actualité, mais il y a eu une affaire de pédocriminalité et d'inceste qui a impliqué le directeur, enfin un des ex-directeurs de Sciences Po.
Wow.
Voilà.
Even if we don't speak French, when we hear pedocriminality, we think it cannot voilà. Be good.
donc je vais pas vous résumer cette affaire parce que c'est hors sujet. Simplement, donc Xavier Gorce a fait dans le cadre de cette série qui met en scène deux pingouins qui sont en train de débattre d'un sujet d'actualité. A traité, comme il l'a toujours traité, et de manière totalement ironique, ce sujet. Le monde a été assailli de messages sur les réseaux sociaux, l'accusant de faire la promotion de la pédocriminalité, de ce qui n'était absolument pas le cas évidemment. Simplement le ton du dessin de presse, le cartoon, c'est ironique. Comme l'a dit Daryl, un dessinateur, il tape sur la tête du lecteur, il le secoue. Donc le monde n'a pas supprimé le dessin, mais s'est excusé auprès de ses lecteurs, en imaginant au fond que tous ces messages représentaient la majorité de son lectorat, ce qui n'était évidemment pas le cas, puisque c'était le fait tout simplement de ce qu'on appelle des trolls.
Okay, let's translate. This is a great example.
So this example, it's quite recent. It's about Le Monde, which is the most famous newspaper in France, general, quite neutral politically speaking. So Le Monde has on the front page since many years a series of cartoons made by Xavier Gorce, which is one of the famous cartoonists in France, integrating two penguins chit-chatting with different subjects. And so in France, we have a huge pedocriminal scandal, which mm-hmm. involved the head of the most famous political science school in France. So, of course, he resigned, but that's not the thing. And so this cartoon was talking about this horrible issue. And so, yeah, two penguins chit-chatting. And, of course, it's ironic. But there was a huge debate about is it the incest or is it pedocriminality? What's the stance? What's the difference between one and the other? Because there was not biological links between the accused and the person who accused him. So the Le Monde received a lot of complaints, and they finally apologized and broke off the links with this cartoonist, who finally resigned. Just because they think that some of the complaints they received on social media was the general thinking of all their readers,
of all their readers.
So they made a huge reaction, and of course it just gets worse, because there is now the debate about should they have to apologize or should they have to retract themselves. So that's one.
Well, this is the kind of thing the New York Times has been under. Lots of pressure, and this is the example that I brought up when we at the opening of this conversation about James Bennett losing his job. So this is the question of sort of what is the impact of these social media campaigns. Danielle, let me ask you. You just came from running the Root newsroom. You're now running the HuffPost newsroom. What are the pressures that come to bear, and do you think I'd love to hear your take on sort of what happened at the New York Times, and whether that is a concerning trend, or what's happening at Le Monde, you know, the most prominent French paper that is choosing to apologize over a cartoon that 10 years ago would have just been a cartoon that some people liked and some people didn't like, and that's the nature of opinions.
I think it's important, you know, as a leader in a newsroom, to be able to discern when public outcry, you know, meets the level of where you actually need to, like, make a real measured response about it. The reality is that people always felt strongly about these things. The difference is it was very aggressive to actually pick up a phone and call somebody or actually mail a letter, you know, to your newspaper or to any publication about how you felt about something they did. Now it's really quick and easy. You can just fire off a tweet. You can do it anonymously. You can leave a comment on a page, and it can just snowball and become a thing that's even bigger than you ever would have anticipated. And that's why it feels so different from in the past. Like, these people have always had these opinions. They just didn't necessarily have the access to be able to express them so easily and abundantly and coordinate around them so easily. So I think it's important, again, to know the difference of what you're up against. Like if you're dealing with legitimate criticism where you've made a mistake and now you have to correct it, then of course you should address it and be honest and forthright with people about, you know, what changes you're going to make or put in place to avoid, you know, a mistake like that happening again. But if you feel that you are being unfairly besieged, you know, like if it's where you're just basically just being railroaded by a group of people who just don't like your opinion, you have to decide, are you going to just weather the storm and stand up to that? Or are you going to just succumb to the will of the masses, even though it's something you don't actually believe in? Like you don't agree with these people who are coming after you. So you really have to decide where you're going to stand your ground ultimately on these issues.
Susie?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, even this conversation has been so wide ranging, right? So, you know, I think when we talk about governments suppressing free speech, that isn't the same thing as cancel culture, right? That's not the same thing as Gannett deciding they don't want to have transphobic cartoons, right? So I think like the thing to really think about in terms of how we deal with these issues is sometimes, you know, there's going to be noise. And part of our job is to sort of encourage conversation and sometimes difficult conversation. But if it feels like the criticism is valid, if, you know, a year or two ago, someone might have published a transphobic cartoon, they're not going to publish now because they think twice, that's not a bad result, right? So like everything else, there's sort of like kernels in this that are good, that sort of force people to think more before they act and speak and write, that sort of force us to ask ourselves what our internal biases are and whether or not we're sort of being casually dismissive of someone who doesn't deserve that. And then there's this other thing that happens, which is that people aren't allowed any grace, right? So if you use the example that you used in the introduction of the woman who got the editor position at Teen Vogue.
Right, and Alexi McCammond, right.
Alexi, mm-hmm. And then she had apologized. You know, I think there were valid concerns about, you know, she was taking on the job of an editor of a teen magazine. And so the fact that she had made those comments when she was a teenager sort of were more relevant than they might have been for someone else, right? So it's complicated, but the question then sort of became like, was there any room for grace for her? Is there any scenario where she could have apologized enough or done it in a way that kind of satisfied this sense that she had behaved inappropriately? And I think that's what we don't have really room for, that because the conversations become so flattened, we don't really have a relative scale, right? We don't have the sense of this person, like Harvey Weinstein is a monster. He's not being canceled, he's a monster. And, you know, this person said something on social media I don't like, and so I want them to apologize for it, right? There's like this sort of huge breadth of ways we talk about this. And I think that's actually doing a disservice to people who do actually want, you know, some accountability when things are not well framed, right? Mm-hmm. Well,
I'd
like to jump in because ahead, she Darryl. Brought up yeah. the New York Times. Editorial cartoonists don't like the New York Times. They're a great example of outrageous overreaction and counterculture, cancel culture. So the New York Times had a low-level editor make a poor decision to print an anti-Semitic cartoon in the international edition of the New York Times. And they got deserved blowback for that. And in response to that, they decided to make a policy of never, ever printing an editorial again in any of their publications, an editorial cartoon again, which is a crazy, crazy overreaction. You know, they've made stupid decisions about words they shouldn't have printed in the past. They haven't decided to stop printing words. I would much prefer that they stop printing words and print cartoons instead. That would leave a much more balanced publication. So they don't publish the editor and they kick out every darn cartoonist. And at the same time, you know, they were hosting an international cartoon syndicate and they kicked that syndicate out on their ear because they wanted nothing to do with editorial cartoons ever again. And that syndicate had a very tough time trying to keep their business going after losing their method of distribution. You know,
so hang on, finish your thought and then, yeah, go ahead.
Well, there is, you know, you guys were talking about measured response to these things. A large problem is that these responses often are not measured. Often they are just crazy. And the New York Times is a perfect example of crazy.
Well, so this is what I wanted to get to, because I would like Danielle and some and people of her, let's say, spine, be the people who are in charge of all of our media publications. But unfortunately, we know that institutions are tend to be cowardly, actually, and they will cave to protect the institution. I used to work at the New York Times, and I felt that was one of the most important things that I learned when I worked there, is that thinking that I was working at the beacon of free expression and accountability to government and public officials, what I discovered working inside the beast is that it's actually an institution like every other institution. It's an important institution. I cherish it and I revere it, but it behaves like an institution. And so when institutions are under threat, and Charlie Hebdo, I think, is quite an interesting outlier in that it continues, that Charlie Hebdo continues to do the work, because maybe you guys are contrarian by nature, even in the wake of a massacre of that kind. But institutions are fearful and cowardly, as Daryl's experience with the people just choosing not to publish the Trump cartoons to avoid, you know, the hassle of readers attacking, you know, is one thing. And then on the other hand, my experience as an editor of a newsroom is that the journalists in the newsroom themselves are also, not everyone is as strong and able to sort of say, well, that's just an opinion and too bad. And, you know, this is my reporting, and that they start pulling their punches. So I'd love to hear anybody or cartoonists start pulling their punches, for example. I just would love to hear from any of you as to that those ripple effects of the atmosphere in general.
You know, I just feel like criticism of all kinds, whether warranted or not warranted, is part of the price of admission of being someone who speaks out publicly and has an opinion. You have to be able to know the difference or be able to discern when the criticism is legitimate and you should do something about it, and when it's simply, as Susie said, just noise. Because there's always noise on the internet. There's always people complaining about something. There's always going to be individuals who feel they have been wronged somehow by popular culture or the media or et cetera, et cetera. So to me, it's silly. Like, if you're an institution like the New York Times that's been around for hundreds of years, and you're just afraid of like people like not liking Trump cartoons because you want to, I don't understand that. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. Like, I get, I mean, like, the criticism, yes, might hurt your feelings. Like, oh, they accuse you of having a certain bent one way or the other, but that shouldn't like stop you from speaking truth to power and standing up against those who seek to, you know, wrong and abuse people through the power that they have. So it's just, I mean, I don't know, like maybe like, I don't know if the fact my own personal experience with hate mail and harassment has just made me like not as sensitive to these particular issues. But to me, it all has to be put in perspective. There's a big difference between just a bunch of people complaining and legitimate criticism.
Well, and also I think the issue with the New York Times is that they're so reactive. Like it feels, and also really varied in their responses. So someone will do something and they will come down really hard on that person. Someone else will do something that seems worse. They'll be like totally fine with that thing. Like it feels part of the problem with the New York Times is that the sort of culture is shifting around them. And like any sort of big organization that's not very used to change, they're just struggling to know what the right reaction is. And so they're just making different reactions each time. And it satisfies no one, and it leaves the newsroom feeling like they don't know what they're supposed to kind of do or not do, right? The decision to just eliminate editorial cartoons because you don't like one of them is just like a super reactive sign that you're not really thinking things through clearly. You're just trying to like, you know, sort of put your finger into the hole as it opens up and hope that that's like enough, right? And I think that's, you know, if for an institution like the Times, they need to take a step back and ask themselves why they can't just come up with like a clear set of policies around what they want in their newsroom. It seems confusing that it's been such like a mess for the last year or so.
Yeah, because it's like, it should start up top. Like, if you are in charge of the publication, you should set the tone about how we're going to approach these issues. If you truly believe in democracy, the First Amendment, having these conversations that are sometimes really difficult, you should stand behind what you put out there. And if you can't stand behind what you put out there, then what are we even doing?
You know? But I do think that you're hitting on one of the most important parts of how cancel culture, as we're defining it, is impacting media, journalism, and the journalistic institutions that keep our societies, you know, hold them to account, hold people to account, which is, I think that it is now being led by the warp and woof of social media waves of outrage. You know, I think that's the danger that I see, because we are seeing some of those effects. I mean, the idea that Le Monde is, you know, the equivalent of the New York Times in France, and that if Le Monde is what Gerard's describing is the same kind of thing. It's like they're wavering on something pretty core, right, Gerard?
Yes, I think I
Thank
try
you.
To.
Your sorry. English is great. Yes, we encourage you and we support you.
Thank you.
It's also much better than my French, if that makes sense.
Thank you. I think that the story of this fact about the New York Times is linked to the very nature of cartoon, because cartoon means trouble. And I don't think that Daryl will agree with me. To draw a cartoon, a political cartoon, is generally you will have troubles with that in one way or another, because the cartoon is often violent. It often touches things that people are very very linked with. So I think that the New York Times doesn't want troubles anymore, and that's very it's a problem to me for such an institution, and it's a problem for journalism generally, not only for cartoons. If today I was a journalist, I'm not cartoonist, I'm journalist. If I was a journalist working for the New York Times, I will be worried about my job.
Yeah, I think that we've really, what we're seeing is, I'm seeing it on the ground. I've said this in private conversations to each of you when I've spoken to you, and it does concern me because you have to be tough to be a journalist. You have to be willing to take criticism. You have to let that roll off you. If you're not sure where your leadership feels, if you're not sure, then you're going to be led by, you know, I hate to use the word the mob, but sometimes it feels like the mob on social media when it's coming at you. And I, you know, certainly I've had it come after me. It just, no matter how, you know, fearless you want to be, it just doesn't, you can't, you're human, right? You just can't help but feel assaulted in some way. And of course, Danielle, 1,000% right. It's nothing like the real life violence that people who experience racism have gone through now and for so long and too long in the past, which is not the fault of journalists. It doesn't mean that social media coming after you feels great.
Yeah, totally. Like, it doesn't feel good, you know, to deal with when people are upset with you because you've like given your opinion and the opinion, like, for whatever reason.
Well, or even if you haven't, you know, we all know how it works.
Yeah, like
it may be something. Yeah, Exactly. Yeah,
and someone just took issue with the headline and didn't even bother to read anything that you actually wrote. But it's like, are you going to ride the wave of people's emotions on social media, or are you going to focus on, you know, delivering information, which is your job? Like, you can't, like, I honestly feel like, you know, some journalists, like, I know people are encouraged to be on social media. Like, I'd be fine with, you know, if anyone on my staff just decided, like, hey, I don't want to be on Twitter anymore, it's an awful place, I'd be like, cool. That's why I barely
really
tweet.
Really.
That's why most of my tweets are about working out.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they're not about politics.
Because I think, like, you know, Danielle and I have worked together. It's like, it's really important to remember that Twitter is not real life, right? It's like, it's sort of the point that Gerard was making about Le Monde. It's like, the loudest people don't necessarily reflect your entire readership, right? So part of it is just, you have to decide as a leader what you believe and what your organization stands for. And then you have to stick to that. You can't just decide week by week whether or not you're, like, worried about what Twitter thinks. Like, that's just not gonna work.
There's nowhere to live.
Yeah, no. But it is a balancing act, because, you know, you also don't want to be unresponsive to your readers. You want to be listening to them, and it's just, but it tends to be the loudest. Before we wrap, I just want to ask one question to Gerard, and that I'll then also bounce to all of you. Have you seen a diminishing in the sort of young people who want to become cartoonists in the wake of what happened to Charlie Hebdo? Is there just a diminished enthusiasm or a fear that holds people back from wanting to pursue that as a career?
No, because it's always been difficult to find press cartoonists in France. Everyone wants to do cartoon,
cartoon.
Like superheroes, or
right,
to write this kind of stories, you know, to draw this kind of stories, and the what we call in France press cartooning is it's always been difficult to find, above all in Charlie Hebdo, which is a media, which is a newspaper, where cartoonists are not just put away. They have their own space. There are real journalists also. They're not
for sure.
So no, we found new cartoonists, young cartoonists, since 2015. They're good.
They're good. that's an encouraging note for us to wrap on, that there are still young people who are willing to get out there and speak their mind and tell the truth. And I think it's just going to be an evolving conversation, understanding how to respond to these waves of pressure and influence and what we call cancel culture, however that definition continues to shift and change. Thank you so much, Danielle, Suzy, Daryl, Gerard, especially all the way from Paris. Thank you so much for this fascinating conversation. And we appreciate your thoughts and caring about what's happening to journalism in the world. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
That discussion was just part one in the wrap series, Conversations on Cancel Culture. Part two, we'll dive into cancel culture in film. Part three, about comedy. I'm going to be moderating that one. And part four will be about coming back from being canceled. We're releasing a different discussion each week. And for more information, you can check out therap.com/cancel-culture-series.
And that is it for this week's episode of The Wrap Up. Thank you to all of our listeners. And remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.